you know, we always offer the EchoLink as an alternative method.
Yeah, I'm not right now by the repeater because seeing I'm in Lindenhurst, and that's why I'm not close to the repeater because I know the repeater's out in Plainview, and I'm all the way in Lindenhurst. This is KD2ZEP.
Okay, yeah, I understand. You know, we're not all close to the antenna all the time, and sometimes the antennas don't quite pick us up, even though, you know, I transmit from the same exact place week in and week out. But a couple weeks ago, I was not as well received by the repeater. So, you know, it's all subject to change. But, Brian, I'm glad you were able to get in, and I hope you'll participate in future episodes of the Technical Net.
Oh, I would definitely do, because I'm right now working on a general, and I'm trying to get more into this, and I need some more info and stuff. Back to you.
Well, you know where to find us, Brian. We're here every Sunday night at 8 p.m., and you're always welcome. Once again, I'm AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Net. If anyone has any other comments on this particular subject before we move on to our next one, feel free. Hit that push-to-talk button.
WB2BXO, how are you, Roy?
I am fine, Frank. I hope the world is treating you well as well.
Well, it's nice to have some sunspots back. Let's put it that way. Yeah, things are pretty good. I experimented with the MFJ magnetic loop briefly years ago, probably around 1990 or so, when I was moving from my parents' place to an apartment in Brighton Beach. And anyway, as I recall, and the technology may have improved quite a bit since then, as I recall, the MFJ loop had negative gain over a dipole, was of course very high Q since they're very short, which meant on most bands they were very narrow banded. And I just wasn't impressed with an antenna that was a negative gain over a dipole. And when I tried to set up at my apartment in Brighton Beach, which was first of all, the apartment was a Faraday cage, and second of all, every time somebody hit the elevator button, the noise level went to 40 over 9. I decided not to pursue it. Anyway, that was my observation and brief experimenting with it. The negative gain over a dipole, difficult to keep tuned, but hopefully those things have improved quite a bit. Go ahead.
Well, not really as far as I'm aware. It's gotten, you know, beefier and more clever electronics. Ultimately, despite what I've read to the contrary, I believe magnetic loops are fundamentally shortened dipoles, and so you're going to have lower radiation resistance, which means higher effective insertion losses and less efficient antenna modes, and the high Q that you mentioned as well. It has benefits, but it also has prices. If it didn't have those costs, then everyone would just go out and get themselves a magnetic loop antenna. The benefit of a magnetic loop antenna is that they are not height restricted. You don't have to worry about elevating them to a half wavelength above ground. They can be placed roughly about 8 or 9 feet above ground, and they'll work as well as any other elevation. And they're much more mobile. They're easy to move around. They're much more portable. You don't require any kind of radials or counterpoises, and they're self-contained. So there's a lot of pluses. The downside, as I mentioned, as you mentioned, is the high Q and the inefficiency. So for what they provide, they're a nice antenna. They're not a perfect antenna by far. If you have the space and the elevation for a half-wave center-fed dipole, you'll get out farther with one. But most people in Brooklyn and Queens don't have space for a lot of those things. And so, you know, I know people who take a magnetic loop and shove it over by the window in their house, in their apartment house, and they get out. They don't get out terribly well, but at least they get out.
Something I'd like to look at again at some point. It's an interesting idea. Yeah, just about everything when in urban amateur radio now is a compromise. When I have tried listening in the apartment, the condo I'm in now in Philadelphia, the noise level is so high I've been really discouraged from investing anything in it. And anyway, we have a little more time. Maybe I'll go into it a little more. But anyway, yeah, I think the noise levels are really a limiting factor now in urban ham radio. I think you've mentioned that yourself. Anyway, go ahead and move on to the next thing. Just thought I'd put my 2 cents in. That'll be your B2BXO.
Okay, I appreciate that, Frank. There's a lot of chatter about how magnetic loops operate differently than all the other antennas, and that most other standing wave antennas operate with electric fields and magnetic loops. And why they call them magnetic loops is because they operate on the magnetic field, and so they're less sensitive to electrical noise production, and they're less noisy receivers. I don't really cotton to that. Again, I prefer to consider them as a variation of a shortened dipole. That makes a lot more sense to me. Saying that an antenna utilizes the magnetic fields only versus electric fields only is like saying that a quarter is just a heads, not a heads and a tail. So I think you can't have one without the other, personally. But that's my opinion. Anyway, let me drop for a second. If anyone has any other comments before we move on, you might as well tell me them now. Very well. Let us move on to our next person on our list, Ryan K0BB. What's your question, topic, or comment for tonight, Ryan?
WB2BXO.
I'm sorry, Frank. I stepped all over you. You want to repeat yourself, please?
I said I'm sure we can count on Wesley at some point to explain the physics of the magnetic loop as it pertains to electromagnetic fields. Because, yeah, that sounds a little sketchy to me. I think the reason the noise level is lower is because the gain is even lower than a dipole, and also because it's directional and probably has very little to do that it operates in, on magnetic fields rather than electrical fields, because they're one and the same thing. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would agree with you. Basically quantum mechanically, and I don't want to stay on this subject any longer than I have to, but it has to do more with your frame of reference. From one frame of reference, something is a magnetic field. From another frame of reference, that's an electric field. And so electromagnetism is kind of joined at the hip. You sort of can't have one without some aspect of the other. But we'll leave quantum electrodynamics for another night. Next on our list is Ryan K0BB. I hope you're still with us, Ryan. Yeah, unfortunately, the background noise, I couldn't make out any of that. So hopefully if the background noise doesn't come back, give it another try, please. Yes, I hear you, zero. I hear you, K0, Bravo, Bravo.
I wasn't sure if it was my turn yet. I had to go upstairs. I was portable the whole time.
Yeah, we're up to you now, Ryan.
Oh, great. Okay, so let me get a signal report real quick. How much noise is there?
Right now, you're full quieting. Your audio is kind of low. You probably could kick it up to 6 additional decibels and not clip.
All right, well, let me try talking to the mic. I came on last week and talked about the antenna I was building with a ground tuner, antenna tuner, and a noise canceling system. And I wanted to give an update on that and tell a little story and then ask a question, if that's all right.
Yeah, sure. Please do.
So I tried a couple of antenna configurations. Actually, the ground tuner and the antenna tuner with the compromised ground, the two TV antenna radials sticking out of the bottom with the vertical on top and the loaded coil, you know, the whole buddy system, worked out really well. And the only problem was I was picking up so much noise with it. I even talked at one point with KG2OGD, who was working on the same band out on Long Island, and I asked him what the noise floor was. He said, "Oh, it's perfectly quiet." And in the city, on my vertical, I was getting maybe S5, S6. And, you know, the noise canceler did absolutely nothing to filter it out. And I put a random wire out that just didn't do anything. And so I decided to try a different setup. I tried kind of like a doublet, but a very short doublet, using the two radials and some ladder lines. I built a little short doublet, and it actually worked pretty well. It tuned it to a lot of different bands, even though it's only about 154 inches total. I was able to tune it down to 40 meters, down to about 2 SWR on 40, almost 1 on every other band. The only problem was, you know, I couldn't transmit very far with it. It's not very high off the ground. Let me drop for a second. It's not very high up off the ground. I can't transmit very far with it. You know, I tried, when I had the vertical, I was able to talk to Lithuania. I made a contact with Lithuania on single side band. When I did CW, I was able to hit the reverse beacons all around the country. When I used this antenna, I could not even talk to someone in Virginia. But a very strong signal to me, and I couldn't, the CW, I only made it to Baltimore. So I think this antenna is not as good for transmitting. But I had the idea of combining them together and actually using the vertical with a real counterpoise now, and using the two radials as a dipole below it, horizontally polarized with a receive antenna, using the noise canceling system to mix the two antennas together to get the best reception, lowest noise reception from mainly the dipole. And then using the vertical as a transmitting center. And I guess my question is, I wanted to know what the coupling would be possibly between the horizontal dipole and the vertical and the counterpoise systems, which are all so close together.
Well, theoretically, in a perfect universe, antennas that are at right angles of each other in terms of polarity do not interact. On a theoretical basis, the dB loss from a horizontal to a vertical antenna is infinite. We don't live in a theoretical world though, so that's out the window. There will be a degree of coupling, It sort of depends on a whole bunch of different factors. Might I suggest as well as another option, if you find that your doublet worked to a degree but couldn't really go very far, have you considered orienting your doublet instead of horizontally orienting it vertically?
You know, that's a really good idea. I hadn't considered that. It's a little tougher mechanically for me to do. I'm using a tripod as a mat, along with some extension tubes. But I could try it out. See, I have a bunch of things to begin with. So I'll see if I can do that. I'll try and report back on that as well. I'll try both configurations. I'll try the vertical receive, transmit receive system, and the dipole. Then I have another story to tell real quick, if that's all right.
Sure. As soon as I finish saying my little 2 cents worth, I just want to explain to the audience. Many know, but I'll repeat it for those who already know. The problem with horizontally polarized antennas is that they really benefit from height. If you even have a shortened doublet, it's still horizontally oriented, so you will get ground coupling, and it will absorb some of the RF. It will also reflect off the ground and produce, rather than a horizontal takeoff angle where it will skip the horizon into the ionosphere, it'll go straight up into the clouds and just warm up the clouds and then go into outer space. So that's why horizontally oriented antennas benefit from height. Usually you want them to be at least a half of a wavelength above ground potential in order for it not to be a near vertical incidence sky wave that just kind of is good for very local communications but terrible for distance. On the other hand, if you rotate it into a vertical orientation, it now radiates across its you know, or at a right angle to its element, and it has a decent takeoff angle, and you don't have to worry about things like that. You still have to worry about coupling to ground if you get very close to the ground, but you'll have a better takeoff angle, so that might help.
Yeah, that fits pretty much with my experience, the engine, near vertical, skywave. Yeah, because, you know, like I said, when I did my CW reverse beacon check, I was only able to hit Baltimore, which sounds about right for a short trip. The story I wanted to tell real quick is just that, let me drop for a second if I had it. The story that I wanted to tell real quick is I'm sitting out today with this doublet in Central Park, which is my usual haunt, my usual QPH, and I had this this person come up, and he was actually an Ukrainian refugee living in Brooklyn. And he came up and sat with me for about a half hour, watching me fiddle with the radio and, you know, asking me questions. Really nice person, and I gave him my email. He actually got back to me and was interested in becoming a ham, and I thought that was about the most wonderful thing that happened to me today. I wanted to share that. I'm always great to spread the hobby. And with that, I'll say back to that, K0DD.
Okay, very good, Ryan. Yeah, it's always a joy when you could kind of talk to hobby and find an interested person. It's great fun when you pick up someone who throws out their call sign and you find out that this is their first time on the radio and, you know, you're their first contact. I'm a big fan, obviously, of this hobby. I think it has such a great depth and breadth to it. It's not a very narrow cast type of a hobby. You know, if you're into bonsai plants, that's fine, but it's basically bonsai plants. There's not much variation. Maybe people into bonsai will think that I'm an idiot as far as bonsai variations. Amateur radio is so diverse. There are so many nooks and crannies. For social people, there are communications aspects. For technologically enthusiastic people, there's all kinds of old and new technology out there. There's things that are, you know, QRP and transceivers that fit in a cigarette case all the way to moon bouncing and meteor scatter. So I understand, and I'm happy to hear that story, Ryan.
Yeah, actually, K0DD, I also wanted to say, you mentioned, the first person I talked to on the radio was ACTTL, who's on the net tonight. So, yeah, back to net, K0DD.
Very good, Ryan, yes. My first contact was a guy who still lives on in the archives of the technical net. A guy named Alex was a common person, a common contributor on the TechNet back in, I think it was 2028, something like that. Anyway. So Alex, unfortunately, I forget Alex's call sign. He moved to Romania. I think he must have passed away more than a few years ago because he was not very, very agreeable with his medications. But anyway, again, this is AC2GS, and we'll move on to our next person on our little list tonight, Jim, KD2VHD. What do you got for us tonight, Jim?
Good evening, Roy and the group. Simple stuff tonight, and one new simple question that just came up. I've often heard the term doublet used, and most of the time people seem to refer to it as the same thing as a dipole, and sometimes I hear a reference to something different, and I don't quite get the reference. Could you explain if there's a difference at all between a doublet and a dipole?
Yes, I can. AC2GS, by the way. A dipole is a two-element resonant antenna. So that's why we usually talk about half-wave center-fed. Doublets are two-element, but they're not resonant. So the concept is that you make up the lack of resonance later on using some impedance-matching circuit like an antenna tuner. Now, the problem with that is that the more you have to correct a impedance mismatch on most transmission lines that we hams use, the greater the loss and the lower the efficiency of the radiating antenna. So using a doublet with a coaxial cable is not a good idea. But what some people do, very few, because unfortunately very few people feel comfortable with open line transmission lines, is they use open line transmission lines. Now, people of a certain age recall seeing a variety of that. Their 300-ohm antenna for their TV set was a open line. Open lines have benefits and prices, like most things in physics. The benefit is that it has very low attenuation loss, and if you have reflections, the attenuation losses mount up, but since they are nominal, you can get away with them. The downside is they are not isolated in the same way a coax cable is. You can put five or six coax cables next to each other, and they don't care because there's about 100 dB of isolation between each one. That is not the case with open line. If you start to put metal objects near open lines, you will get problems. So you have to be a little bit more thoughtful for open lines. But again, you can connect them to a non-resonant doublet, a double-element object that isn't inherently resonated, and tune it with your antenna tuner. And many people really like that. I knew more than a few people who it was their preferred quick and dirty antenna.
Wow, that really clarified a few things. I appreciate that. So if I'm gathering it, a dipole is going to excel in efficiency, and a doublet is going to be better at multi-band versatility if you can tune it appropriately. Do I have that correct?
Correct. That is the gist of it. You know, like I said before, physics always requires that you pay a price when you want to cut a corner. And so the corner cut is you have to use a very low-loss transmission line, and be mindful of the efficiencies of how you're going to tune this non-resonant radiator to be of a proper impedance. Now, some people, clever people, and people who are adept at waterproofing equipment will simply take an automated antenna tuner and place it at the feed point of the antenna. Then you can get away with using common coaxial cable transmission line. But then you have to make sure that your antenna tuner operates remotely well and water doesn't get into it. But that's another option. In addition, if for whatever reason open line wire transmission lines are a no-no for people.
Very interesting. Thank you. Second part of the question is having to do with antenna power ratings. I've been looking at some portable merchandise, you know, marketed antennas that are portable, easy to, lightweight, backpacking, that type of thing. And some of them have ratings that are about 100 watts. And then it says they're only rated for 30 watts for digital or CW type use. And I don't quite understand what the difference is that's going into the antenna that would do that. Could you explain those characteristics?
Yes, I can. The difference is something called the duty cycle. In FM and CW, it is a full duty cycle, which means when it's on, it's all the way on, especially with FM. You know, from the time that you hit that push-to-talk button until you let go, it's full power, even if you're just sitting there not making a single noise. So it depends upon the duty cycle. With something like single sideband, it's a very efficient mode in that if you hit the transmit button on your single sideband transmitter and sit there nice and quiet, it will not really put out any kind of watts into your antenna until you start to talk. So it's the average full power. The average full power for single sideband is much lower than the peak envelope power of the maximum energy produced at any one instant in time.
Gotcha. So it's time-related and cumulative. Okay, understood. I appreciate that. Two good answers. Thank you very much. I'll give it back to Ned.
Okay. You're welcome, Jim. I think my problem, if anything, is I'm a bit too concise for the purposes of this technical net. So I hope the people out there will help me out with that by supplying more topics and questions. So if anyone out there has any other questions or comments to make tonight, please hit that push to talk and give me your first name and your call sign.
Back in if nobody else is interested. KD2VHD, I'll hop back in if nobody else is hopping in.
I guess you might as well jump in because the people listening tonight, I think, are in listening mode. I hope we can kind of switch them into talking mode later on.
I might be able to help with that.
Okay, Jim, what do you got for us now?
I haven't been around for the last couple of nets. I missed a few, so I'm curious. Has there been any updates on the ham radio balloon thing? I think that's I'll leave the question open like that. Any news?
As far as I'm aware, it's still the conjecture of one amateur radio operator who was involved in the project. The government has not issued any statements whatsoever, yay or nay. My guess is we're not going to hear what those other balloons or whatever those objects were. Any time too soon.
That's too bad. It's a very curious situation. And the fact that it intersected with this group was really very interesting to me. I was curious. I thought myself there'd be more feedback sooner.
EDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
Is this about those other two objects that were sighted along with that balloon allegedly from China?
Yes. There were a few unidentified objects in the sky. Some reports wouldn't even say whether or not they were balloons that were taken down. And there were reports from an amateur radio operator involved in these telemetry balloon amateur radio devices that they lost contact with their balloon telemetry equipment around the same time that it was reported that an object was removed from the sky by military force.
Yeah, one thing I remember hearing, and again, I never saw it repeated, was on CNN, where one of the pilots said that the object that he sighted appeared to have no visible means of propulsion, and yet it was staying aloft and moving. And I haven't seen any word or anything about those objects since. So it is curiouser and curiouser.
I don't want to disrespect fighter pilots because I'm sure they got an ego and probably could beat the whatever out of me, but more often than not, they tend to issue really strange comments that are don't strike me as terribly rational. You have to kind of understand the enormous speeds that these jets are traveling at and the amount of actual personal evidence that you can get from glancing at an object when your velocities in relation to its velocities are rather high. So, I take from that to a degree that he did not see any obvious propellers or anything, but it's possible he missed a small balloon. These are much smaller objects than the Chinese balloon was, where you could see it in the sky anytime, and it was wafting around, and the people visualizing it were stationary as opposed to traveling at Mach 1 or whatever. So I would take these pilot reports with a grain of salt.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. But it is interesting, though, that those latter two objects, there was no balloon or anything involved. The first object, of course, they said it was a balloon. They showed pictures of them popping it with a missile or whatever. But the latter two objects was no balloon at all involved. So I don't know. I mean, it is, they said they were going to hunt down the remains, and then I heard no more about it. They moved on to more important things like what Trump is doing. So I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, all this is open to interpretation. I interpreted what they were saying as kind of not saying anything. They were making it very, very obvious that they wanted to say absolutely positively nothing about anything. So I'm not quite sure if in reality it wasn't a balloon or it was that they didn't want to say it was a balloon. It's kind of difficult with government people to figure out exactly what they're trying to say sometimes.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Okay, very good. Jim, you wanted to say something about this?
From the ham radio side as opposed to the government side, if I understand it correctly, the balloon type that they have supposed might have been involved in one or more of these incidents, I believe it was called a Pico balloon. It mounted to not much more than a Mylar party balloon, with a solar panel hanging below it, maybe the size of a notebook, and this electronics package, maybe the size of a credit card. Very, very minimal equipment. A tiny thing, you know. I suppose that it would set up a radar signature the size of a large bird. easily dismissed, I would imagine. That's what I heard talked about. I'm not saying that's what it is, but that's what I heard spoken about on at least one of the incidents. So it was pretty interesting that apparently it is a ham radio operator to use for weather telemetry.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of fascinating stuff, balloon telemetry, CubeSats, all kinds of fun stuff up there. And, again, the government's kind of not really talking. And it's very, very difficult. You know, jet fighters travel very, very fast, and they rely on electronic equipment. And perspective distortions and such are ripe. They've published a video of jet pilots tracking things that seem to travel at remarkable speeds, except that if you assume that they were not as close or far as you thought they were, they could easily be birds flying. So it's interesting. So far, there's no actual evidence, but I think with the government, you're not going to get any actual evidence. The only thing that the amateur radio operator did was kind of correlate the time and vague location, that roughly within something like a 100-mile radius and approximately plus or minus a couple of hours, the amateur radio balloon disappeared versus the Air Force. So it's very possible one of them was one of those balloons, but, you know, who knows how many years it's going to take for them to take it off the top secret list.
DC?
Yes, Rich?
I don't like the way you said that, Roy. Just kidding. I watched a YouTube last night on the state-of-the-art of cameras, high-altitude cameras, and the resolution thereof. And the biggest problem is storing all that amount, you know, that amount of information, storing it in real time. So what they've had to move to is only storing information where something in the picture has changed. And in that way, you know, of course, that's what you're looking for, something that's changed, something that's moving, or whatever. But I don't have the name of the video, but if I'm not mistaken, they can see down to 14 inches from 14 miles high. And they could even now, they say, discern the expression on people's faces, and with AI, work on that data to do whatever they're going to do. But when you're talking about reading the expression on somebody's face from 14 miles, that's pretty scary. Back to net.
And keep in mind the technology is only going to improve, and the problem with paranoid people is that if you think about it, up until recently, although a lot of things are being recorded and videotaped, or you know, the digital version of that, no one has the money to support the number of eyeballs that need to look at everything. The United Kingdom, to my understanding, is probably has the most closed-circuit television cameras of any country. But, you know, 99% of that material is never scanned by anyone just because they can't afford anything that absurd. But eventually, thanks to artificial intelligence, and it's getting better and better every week, there's an announcement every week, there's a GPT 4.0. There's all kinds of fun stuff in the future. They'll be able to hook up regular computers to do all these photo scanning, and there will be repositories of every time your face lit up any CCTV. So if you like privacy, then buy yourself a cave someplace in Alaska, because otherwise We're all on stage.
Roy, I just wanted to correct myself. Something, a statement I made, I misstated something. Most of the vacuum tube variable capacitors on eBay are pre-owned. So I misstated that. They are pre-owned.
Okay, thanks for correcting yourself, Rich. There's nothing inherently wrong with that. I have mentioned in the past that I have benefited from pre-used electronic equipment. I use transfer switches, which are used a lot in the microwave industry, and because microwave towers and such get refitted seemingly every hour on the hour, there's a lot of very fine quality used microwave equipment, including a microwave transfer switches. So a transfer switch could easily go for new in the box $600, and I've been able to pick them up for under $100. So it puts an extra wrinkle in that you now kind of tend to need to test the equipment. Sometimes they'll just say not tested. Other times they won't say anything, and they might work perfectly fine, or they may not. But, you know, there's always that little wrinkle. Yes, Jim.
Interesting how different technological epochs are crossing through this conversation. And it reminds me of a video I watched this morning on YouTube of an engineer who did a very technical breakdown of an 18th century sailing ship, a sailing warship, I guess a British ship in general. And he had these incredible schematic diagrams actually functioning, working of the ship. And he went through all of its decks, all of its systems, its construction, all that stuff. And absolutely a miraculous piece of engineering work video that described the absolutely miraculous piece of engineering work, this ship and its workings and its crew. And it was every bit as complex as at least an Apple II computer, perhaps beyond that. We sometimes give too much credit to the advance of technology, and the people that came before us were rude. But definitely watch that video if you're interested in the history of technology. And you go, maybe they weren't so dumb.
Hopefully, I have never been foolish enough to suggest that people who came before us were all dumb. We kind of had a similar conversation a few weeks ago where we kind of, someone brought up ancient structures and, you know, our alien civilizations visiting us and, you know, building sphinxes for us. And having read von Däniken when I was in elementary school and gotten that out of my system very early in life, I think that's deeply insulting to our ancestors. There were very, very clever human beings all throughout the recorded history of humanity. Geometry, mathematics, astronomy were understood tens of thousands, you know, at least in Egypt 5,000 years ago, and great things were built. You know, our ancestors were not all cavemen. You know, there are still guys next door who would qualify as a decent caveman, but there were clever people before us, and hopefully there will be clever people after us. And I honor the fact that we all stand on the shoulders of giants here.
Agreed.
Okie doke. Anyone out there with any other comments on this particular subject?
I'll throw a question on your privacy comment previously, if it's okay.
Sure, please.
My famous think bombs in a room. You mentioned that if you like privacy, look elsewhere. And it's a very valid point. So I'll throw it out there to the group. Are you okay with that?
Well, I mean, on the flip side, the question is, what can you do about that? I mean, you could complain. You could vote to have limitations. Will they be effective? I don't know. You know, with simple things like computers, you can try belt suspenders and all kinds of things, and if someone wants to break into your system, chances are they're going to break in. I have tried proxies, VPNs, aliases, all kinds of fun stuff, but there always seems to be some kind of back porch that they could sneak into. So I have told people repeatedly that anything that you write in an email, consider it stuck on an index card on the library bulletin board. Don't email people things that you wouldn't want your rabbi or priest to read. I still think that that's good advice.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree more. You're 100% correct. And there was a reason why I phrased the question the way I did, because I always thought it was important that before you determine whether you can do a thing, you should determine whether you should do a thing. Now, this cat's out of the bag, yet it still is worthy of some introspection on. Are you okay with this?
I think you will find a broad spectrum of responses. The problem is not necessarily my opinion or your opinion, but the guys who have a couple of billion dollars of defense money funds and that go unchecked. It's what they would like. I think that's unfortunately what's going to determine the future for us.
BBH with a comment.
Yes, John.
Agreed, and my question stands. I started to pop in, and you can go with the comment.
A couple of years ago, I used to attend these conferences. They were called HOPE conferences, which stood for Hackers on Planet Earth. They were given by this magazine called 2600 Magazine, which was a hackers magazine. But anyway, one of the regular talks there was given by a private detective, and the title of his talks was essentially, Privacy is Dead, Get Over It. And he proceeded to show how he could ask a person to try to conceal themselves anywhere in the United States, and he would be able to find them by various different methods. So, in summary, privacy is dead. You really have to get over it.
Yeah, John, I would agree with you. It's unfortunate. But it's true. 2600 was an interesting magazine. It goes back historically to a AT&T frequency that was used for devices called blue boxes, which were fascinating devices, which I had scribbled out as schematic using a brand new shiny phase lock loop to produce my own blue box that I never got around to producing. So phone phreaking was a fascinating subject, and I'm reminded of Captain Crunch and a whole bunch of strange characters who were part of the phone freaking that later became hackers as personal computers came into their own. But, yeah, if you're a real stickler for privacy, I don't know what to tell you. I think the most effective private person up until a point was the Unabomber, and even he got caught.
Oh, Roy, you're touching on something very near to my dear to my heart, but as I say, statute of limitations won't let me comment on it too much.
Okay, when you go past the statute of limitations, tell me, and we'll have a long chat about it. I was very fascinated by the subject. I remember I was looking for, I had the phase lock loop circuits, and I didn't have the frequencies. And for some strange reason, I contacted an engineer at WMCA, And he offered to trade me the frequencies for the schematic for the phase lock loop. So I never did it, so you can't arrest me for anything. But still, fascinating subject, a lot of lore, a lot of books written about it, a lot of interesting characters that tango through that line of history.
Oh, yes, very many stories I could tell about that. I used to work at Bell Laboratories in Naperville on the number 4 ESS switching system, which was right around the time that blue boxes and everything were being used and were various different methods to get around them and stuff like that there. We could go on for hours, but as I say, statute of limitations prohibits.
When Wozniak met Steve Jobs, they met over phone freaking.
Yes, Rich. They did. They were the phone freakers were kind of the pre personal computer hackers. They were the first guys who did dumpster runs. They would pull technical manuals out of companies' garbage bins before they were destroyed, and copy them and share them with each other and figure out the weak points of entry. And they did a lot of social hacking before there were computers to hack. So yes, indeed, that was kind of the seed for Silicon Valley. I am sure that people of a certain age that are still around in Silicon Valley can trace themselves back to phone freaking.
There were days when there were many, many groups across the land that discovered that the phones worked by a set of tones, and all you had to do is play those tones into the phone, and you could connect anywhere in the world. Those were the days. Statute of limitation, I think, has run out on that one.
I don't know about that. Thankfully, I'm not a lawyer. Yeah, that was the famous blue boxes were two-tone generators, and the two tones were realized, and you could get into the long-distance line trunks, and by issuing the proper two-tone sequences, capture a circuit and make phone calls all over the world. And there were guys who kind of screwed around with it in creative ways. They would go into a telephone booth and they would relay phone calls all around the world until it got to the other phone booth next to them. And so you'd have the latency. So you'd connect with the phone booth next to you. You'd pick up your phone and say hello, and then you go up to the other phone, wait 10 seconds, 15 seconds, and hear hello. So they did really weird things. Then there were black boxes, which were a little cruder, which were just basically a resistor that tricked the telephone system into misinterpreting the circuits. And there was, I think, a red box as well. And, Captain Crunch got his name because he was able to control these telephone lines using a Captain Crunch whistle.
The Mafia did it the easy way. They just took a crowbar to the coin box.
Well, sometimes subtlety is more interesting than crude. Yeah, you could always do it that way. John, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I think it was the Captain Crunch cereal. They had a whistle in there at one time, which hit 2,600 hertz, which was the on-hook tone for the trunk. Actually, that same tone is used in the space shots at the end of transmission tone. That is 2,600 hertz also.
Oh, that's interesting. I think I saw there had to be a dozen, if not more, books on phone freaking, and one of them I'm sure had a cover with the guy that used to go by the name Captain Crunch, with him holding one of those Captain Crunch whistles. I can practically see it in my mind's eye. I'm telling you, it's not everyone was aware of it, but people who were kind of interested in computers even before you could own one tended to be the type of person who were interested in these odd methods of hacking the telephone system, because, you know, the telephone system, I guess, was the closest thing to a computer network that we had. So it's kind of interesting how it drew a hodgepodge of people that kind of almost defined the slightly illegal aspects of the computer revolution and some of the legal ones.
They've taken all the fun away from it. Because now all of the switching and control signals are out of band. They're on a separate, completely separate network. I think it's the current incarnation of it is Signaling System 7. But I remember when I was at the labs, that's what they were working on, with what was called common channel inter-office signaling, where rather than having signaling going over the talking path, all signaling was going over a completely separate data network, so nobody could mess around with it.
Well, such things are ultimately inevitable, but, you know, when you nail down one thing, another thing pops up in its place. So I am sure there are a lot of security issues. I mean, we hear about it almost every other day. Right now, a lot of smart hackers are spending a lot of time stealing cryptocurrency. These are usually government-run agencies, North Korea, Russia, and China, and a few others, where they basically finance hacking groups to just assault these repositories of cryptocurrency. Just the other day, I think some group lifted $100 million worth of cryptocurrency. So, you know, pretty good salary if you can get it, and you don't mind doing illegal things.
I could never understand cryptocurrency, and tell you the truth, I really don't want to understand it, but I really don't understand how it works or what the deal is about it. All I know is it's something I don't want. Go ahead.
Yes, thankfully it's not much of a problem with our little technical net group, because demographics being what it is, I think there's a greater allure among Zoomers, Generation Zs, and Millennials and types. We actually went into it long form about a year or two ago, and so I'm sure no one wants me to rehash it. It is an interesting technology in search of a problem to solve. It is actually used in GitHub, which is a repository for source code for programs, in which it authenticates the entries, which is fine. It's when you start to use it for imaginary valuation. At its core, it's basically a public Excel sheet that says how much you promise to give someone else of imaginary currency. And if everyone kind of loses interest in the currency, its demand goes down and its price goes to zero. So it's very easy to lose your entire wallet. And also because it's based on pseudonymous, as opposed to anonymous, encrypted accounts, if someone can figure out your account, they can steal all your money and get away with it. So it's a wonderful method of stealing people's money. That seems to be the best use plan for it, unfortunately, which is very problematic.
PhD.
Yes, Jim.
So I claim no mastery of the subject. It's a complex subject, as complicated as loop antennas. But I will say that far too many people express their understanding of cryptocurrency, and they don't understand what money or currency itself is, and it ain't much. The whole thing is these days is not much more than an ill-kept promise. Just who is making the promises is really the thing. And I'm oversimplifying, and I don't truly understand the topic. I just know enough about it to know there's a lot of fugaziness in it, from stem to stern and from left to right.
W2PND comment.